Playing. This is October the 13th or 14th, 14th maybe, 1988, and we're here at Rodney Jennings' farm outside of Wanawak, Wisconsin. And he worked on the farm in 1942.
Badger and...
Just a minute. Rodney's saying when he was on the farm, he was probably the last horseman, and now Grandpa's saying about that team of bays that was still there at the end.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we just kept them around, and didn't have a harness on them for several years anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they got so wild that you couldn't even approach them.
Boy, that was a nice team. I always remember Mr. Griffiths, you know, that was your foreman on the farm there.
Yeah.
One time was planting corn, and he brought them in, and he unhooked all the tugs but one. And he dropped the neck yoke down, and they took off for that barn and went in there into that barn. I don't know how both horses went through that door, but they got through there. They pulled that tug of that cord plier right in there, but they didn't do any damage.
He had all the tugs on it.
Except one.
One.
Yeah.
And that dragged the thing right
over. Sure, dragged it right over into that barn.
into which barn?
Into the horse barn behind the round barn.
Oh, yeah.
There was a horse barn there.
And what was he hauling behind the tugs?
Corn planter.
The corn planter.
Yeah, he was playing corn.
And the corn planter was sort of a little thing, wasn't it?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Not the kind of planters they have now.
These were for a horse. Yeah,
I remember
with the tongue in a row.
Sitting on
sure, yeah.
One mm-hmm. seat and something
yeah,
behind.
Yeah, you had a lever that you raised it up at the ends, you know, and then you put it back down.
So that last time I drove a corn planter myself was with a two planter and I'm hauling behind a little tractor.
Oh, sure.
And I wanted to get the corn in. It was getting late and... So I worked at night, and I didn't have too good lights on my tractor. You see how that corn came up.
I always said, just as long as they don't cross, that's the only thing.
Hold on for good pictures.
Yeah, and then you had that black, you had that blind horse with a blaze face, and then that one little mare, and she would kick that Molly, you called her, and you remember they stood in the back of the barn and my brother-in-law, I got him to come up the spring that I went to work for Hughes. I went in down there in January. Long May or June, I got Robert Holmes to come up and go to work for you folks, because that was good wages up there at your place at that time, you know, and it was hard times over around Gaze Mills and like down there too. So he came, but he was scared to death of that. Then they ran away with him. That was what he told you him about. They ran away with him and went in the ditch down there right below your house down there.
I think we had a team in Molly, and the name that occurred to me is Maud and Molly.
Well, no, that there big blind horse was a gelding, but I don't know. He was a nice horse to drive, but he was blind, see, and this other one had her eyes.
Didn't say Molly? That
was the one that would kick. Boy, she was kind of about, well, you had to watch her.
I thought Maud and Molly.
I don't know. That big team, I can't remember what the name of those were.
These are little horses.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, then maybe the blind horse was one of the big team, huh? Or was he with Molly?
No, he was that one with Molly, yeah.
Oh.
Well, I got a grandson that I gave him a nickname of Barney. Mm-hmm. Barney, what did he have?
Yeah, you called him Barney.
Because when he was born, he was a big baby, and he had a foot that turned in a little bit.
Oh.
And I was kidding them about this foot. They got it straightened out when he was very young, so... But I've always called him Barney because after that horse of mine that had such big feet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. But I was telling you, Earl Bounds, I was working for his folks.
You see, you started out saying you graduated from high school
in 1940. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then I stayed at home and worked for Bounds, that would be Earl Bounds' folks. Until in January of 1941.
This was up at Gaze Mill?
Yeah, Gaze Mills. And then I came down in 41, the spring of 41, in January, and worked for you. And then when Robert Holmes came up then and there, and I was going to say,
I don't know.
I was getting $30 a month from Bounds over there. I increased my wages, doubled them, come to you. I got 70 bucks a month. Yes, sir, and paid rent. And I lived on Portland and 4th down there. And my wife came down, and Earl Bounds took us out looking for a place to live. And we found this apartment above it. And it was above a tavern, and the railroad ran behind it. And Fairbanks was running full blast at that time in that stoplight there, you know. And two kids from a country come to try to sleep there. We always remember that. And,
well, the rent must have been low.
Yeah, we paid 30 bucks a month for that, 30 bucks a month for...
You know, I don't know what this North Country does for young men. It seems to me we was a big export.
Export, yeah, to Beloit at that time.
The only thing they do export for the most part is...
Sure. Yeah.
The guys they breed up there.
Yeah. But you know, I had a 30 Model A Roadster, and I bought that for $50 when I came down there from my brother-in-law. This that would be Norma's brother, and I drove that down there and worked for Hilton in a real little car. And another thing I have down here, and I said these were really tough times that were about that time, and then. You bought that homogenizer. You remember buying that homogenizer? Yes. You took us all in there, and we had to learn to take that part and put it back together, because I worked off and on once in a while in the dairy there, and that homogenizer, that always kind of stuck in my mind. That was one
That was a big investment.
Yes, it was, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We had to rearrange the plant and so forth, and
Repipe
it a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you had to discover why the milk was tasting funny.
When was that?
Well, after you had homogenized milk, then sometimes the milk would taste funny. Uh-huh. And that was when the sunshine was getting
onto the homogenized
milk.
Oh.
Onto the bottles. And that eventually led you to the amber bottles.
Oh.
But I think it was a while before you determined what it was.
The brown bottle came after I was there.
Yeah.
Well, when you homogenize milk, you break up the fat.
Yeah,
so small,
sure. Yeah, It doesn't rise to the top.
And you've got all that additional surface.
Yeah.
One big globule of fat doesn't have much surface compared to a thousand little ones that are made out of the same thing.
Yeah. How you got down here? You had that outbreak of bangs at that time in that herd there in the round barn. You remember that time?
Tell me about it. I don't remember it. Tell me about
you?
It.
Don't you? Well, see, they came out with it. Of course, they were selling raw milk there, some of it, you know. And of course, you had to have them bangs tested. Well, they did. Well, then there was quite a few reactors in it, and suspects. And then you had to test every 30 days. And up in up in the barn where he lives there. They had those heifers, and we had to catch those, and there was no catcher. Bob Opa and I we would bulldog those heifers and catch them for the veterinary. Boy, they'd take you for a ride across that barn. And then we had to test those every 30 days until you got a clear test. And then you went up north and bought a herd of cows. I remember that, and you brought a little black cow back that looked more like an Angus, but she had a short tail. But it was about the best cow in the whole works.
That's the one that Billy Beetle called Jackie Cow.
I'll bet.
Well, I'll tell you, that cow had some heifer calves, and they were good.
She had bobtail and bob ears.
Yeah,
lost
sure.
Frostbite.
Yeah,
I've got a whole family tree on that cow somewhere.
Yeah,
sir. Yeah.
She did well for you.
Well, yeah. Yes.
Well, the Opel, so there was two Opel.
Well, Bob was the one that worked there when I did.
And then Milton, Rudy came.
Oh, Milton Kinchy was there, and Red Richardson. I forget what his second name was. He was there.
Well, they were, lives in Durant.
Yeah, we know him.
Oh,
Durant.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he was there. And then I was telling your dad, Henry Durst, he was the one that ran the tractor. You had a tractor to do the plowing with, and he was the one. And I'd go out at noon and plow while he ate dinner.
Did I tell you about Henry Durst's problem with drinking?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And the grandpa told her, Mrs. Durst, Henry can't afford to drink. Oh, yes, he can.
Sure.
He's got the money to drink.
Sure. Of course, your dad was deathly against smoking at that time, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He didn't want anybody to smoke. See, my brother-in-law smoked when he came there. But he said, boy, that broke me of the habit. He said, he quit smoking. There was a lot of them that came down there, they quit. Yeah, Robert smoked when he got down there. Yeah, sure.
He did not smoke
cigarettes.
No. Grandpa did some good. He probably, saved him from lung cancer.
And I think there was a lot of other guys. I never smoked, see? Some of those guys had come there, that was terrible. You know, they just wondered if they could smoke. And I said, well, you're taking your chances because Ronald's dad was death of smokers. He did a lot of smoking.
How did you come to the farm in the first place? How did you hear about it?
Through the Bounces.
Through the Bounces. Through the Bounces.
Yeah, Earl Bounds worked for him, and I worked for his dad.
Oh, okay, that's right.
Your dad, you know, with his hearing problem, those big bulls you kept out there in those pens and back, you remember that, how you had those bulls where you took the cows out there to breed them, you know, and they
it was at the
pen.
end of the horse barn.
That's
there
right.
Was a sort of a hay thing, and then
sure.
those bulls were out there
and we had to
there was access from the barnyard,
right yeah,
and they were big metal pens.
Yeah, they were big bulls too, now I tell you. I'll bet they weighed a ton. You had one that was, I don't know whether he would have been classified as a red Holstein or what, but he wasn't a true Holstein, but he had some kind of red in him, you know. And we had to they'd get hoof rot once in a while, and the veterinary come out, and we had to rope them and throw them out in that field just below the house there. And your dad would come out there, and he'd say, Rodney, he always called me Rodney. That was what I thought. I said, Rod Jane, see, and you guys always did call me Rodney down there, see. But later years, Rod was what it called. And your dad would come out there and he'd say, Rodney, is he singing? And then bulls would be just roaring, you know, cutting on their feet, you know, is he singing?
And would he laugh when you'd
say
that?
Yeah, oh, sure. Yeah.
Oh, that's a great story.
Yeah. Yeah. And then another thing, I remember when we there at the farm.
How would you treat the hoof rot? Get in there.
They had to trim them out put medication.
You know what we did on that bangs business? When we got reactors, we sold the cows.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And then it's another 60 days. We would
test again,
and then sell anything.
Sure.
It reacted.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And boy, we lost 30-40 cows a year for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we got cleaned up, and we got a certification that they were bang free.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was posted on the barn.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh boy, that.
That must have been hard on you financially.
We couldn't replace the cows, you see, fast enough.
Yeah.
Because you sell them for beef, and then you'd have to purchase cows for milk.
Milk, yeah, sure. Yeah.
And,
I don't know where you did go. I did remember one time I thought of where it was that you went up north and you bought that load of cows. You bought the whole works, the whole bunch of cows. I remember you.
I remember about them, but I can't remember.
Yeah.
Another thing that I did in that time, Jackie, was to ride all over the country, stopping at farms and buying heifer calves.
Oh,
I'd be in my car and I'd put them in the trunk of my car.
And bring them back and let them grow up to replace them. You could just get one at a time in there, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm. So they only found one at a time.
Well, that must have been cruelty to animals.
they didn't mind.
And then I remember, I don't know, that was about the first alfalfa you'd put in silo, where you decided to put it in there, and we cut it down. We loaded that green alfalfa with a loader onto the flat racks, and then we pitched it into the silo feller. And I believe it was a Scogan that came out there, and he helped me, and we pitched off those there. And if that wasn't a job, that hot weather, you know, the pull of that stuff, it was just wild on there, you know.
It was heavy.
Heavy.
It wasn't even dry.
And we pitched that in. But I think that was probably about the first alfalfa that was put in the silo down around there.
You have somebody, because Patty came and did that for several times. Wasn't there a vat of molasses there that they'd stand and stir the molasses?
You know,
and the molasses,
I believe there was something to that effect.
The molasses went in with alfalfa because there wasn't the sugar to ferment it in the alfalfa,
we
like
we
there was in the cows.
We mixed molasses and water.
Yeah. So I believe there was. You know, I kind of forgot about
let it
that.
Drip on the stuff in the window.
Okay, and why was somebody needed up there by the tank to stir it?
I suppose it would separate, see. It would separate, I suppose, so your molasses would separate from your water, probably, and if you kept it stirred, see, it would be more even. It would be a,
that might have been it, because I remember Pat, you had Patty standing up there and stirring it, the molasses bag.
See, I've got that written down there. Nice bay team right there, that third or fourth one down there.
Yeah, that
was a nice team. And then that, you remember that horse that you had, that riding horse? He was Jeff, they called him Jeff.
Right?
Yeah, and we'd go take him after cows, and boy, he was really a good cow pony. You could ride him.
An awful hard rider.
Yeah, but he was supposed to have been a racehorse or something that got banged up or something.
He was supposed to be a jumper.
Yeah, But he could run, though.
He wrecked his knees, and so he just came down hard. He didn't protect his knees at all.
Yeah.
And I got him from George Garrigan.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah,
well, I knew he rode hard, but I thought all horses were supposed to. That's the way I thought it was.
But he could run. He could run, boy. He could go out across those fields, you know, where we had the cows.
Well, I don't know about hurting him, but he's a jumper on there.
Yeah. And then I got written down here, the threshing crews. We used to thresh with the Blodgetts and the Freetags and Marston's below you there. We had that thrashing run there, and we thrashed back and forth there with those. I remember that.
Yeah. I've had people confess to me that they would sometimes accidentally, on purpose, lose a pitchfork into the thrasher.
Oh, to stop it?
When they were too hot and tired and covered with chaff and needed a rest.
Yeah.
And then everything had closed down while they fished the pitchfork out and repaired it and got going again.
Got
going. And meanwhile, everybody could sit and drink something and sit in the shade and wait for things to go again.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's about the what I remember from down there. And then I left in 43 and came back, and I went on a farm over by Rising Sun, and the fellow was going to have to go to the service, and he bought me out that spring, and they got me, he said that he could get me a good job, and I went to work at a cheese factory just below that over there, and I worked and drove truck there and helped make cheese for a while, and then I got a job at Ritzel Center driving truck for Carnation Company, and I stayed there until I really went to farming in, let's see, I went in 46.
How old were you when you married?
I was 19.
Oh, well, you dragged your wife around on these areas.
Yeah.
Down here then.
Now,
Red lived at the Hill Farm.
I did.
And you
did.
Okay, Rod, I thought you lived at the Hill Farm at one time.
Oh, yeah, I had that down here somewhere.
Okay, tell me about the Hill Farm, because there were some adventures while you were there. A big snow, maybe?
Oh, yeah. Red and I, one time, we lived... I don't know how he was there, because I thought Pete Hoff lived downstairs, but I know that other, there's another house back in when you turn to the left there and start back, it would be about, and it was kind of back in the field there, and I don't know who, someone built a new house back there, Red said, now, because we came by there.
Way back in there,
and Red lived there, and then we had walked out to the main highway around on Turtle Creek and went down, and then someone picked us up out there when we got out to the road. There was a big snowstorm that night.
Who was the guy that worked with seed salesman?
Johnny Sapp.
He was the guy living downstairs.
Pete Hoff lived there.
The place that burned.
Yeah, but the thing didn't burn until 51 or 50. Well,
yeah,
50.
Pete Hoff lived downstairs. When I was there, Pete and Charlotte Hoff, they were from down in Illinois, they came up there from, and Ken Little was one of your routes, and then that was a brother-in-law of Pete Hoff's, and he lived there in that,
That farm must have had a fairly good reputation, to get so many of you fellas out of the north.
Yeah,
And so many relatives came.
Yeah.
People came and brought their relatives.
Yeah. Well, Orland Potts is my cousin, see? And he actually kind of got the word about
Orland.
Orland is your cousin, okay.
Cousin, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
I see him every day or two.
Do you? Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, and we go over there and... So he came down from this area too, huh?
From Soldier's Grove.
From Soldier's Grove.
Yeah, who makes the airplane, not you.
That's another cousin of Orland's. Makes those airplanes out of beer cans.
Oh.
I don't know if it's a cousin on your side of the family or on his wife's side of the family. Might be on his wife's side of the family.
Yeah, might it be.
Yeah.
I've never heard about that at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the story I remember about the... About the big snowstorm. Maybe that was an earlier one that Fanny was telling about.
37.
Where everybody hiked out and went, even though there was a big snowstorm, and they all hiked out from the hill farm and went dancing at...
Brad and I, we walked that one time out to the highway. We went out there by the Turtle Town Hall.
There,
and then someone came and picked us up. We couldn't get out of there at all. We walked out to the road out there.
Those big storms were in 36 and 37, I think.
Yeah, those are the ones that Fanny's told me about, and that's when they were living there.
Yeah, Fanny and 42 is when I was there.
Well, you know Vehemence, of course.
That's
Roy and Fanny.
I should, no.
You know, I think Roy and Fanny were gone for a few years and then came back.
Yeah. See, I mentioned Ronald to
it.
Ask Fanny, but I think that there was a hiatus there, and then they came back and...
They sort of deserted me, and I don't know, I don't remember now why they left.
Well, something happened there, and with them or whatever, and then it's...
He worked for Fred, he did something with Fred Wallace. Fred Wallace was his... role model and so forth. Roy never did a thing. Fred Wallace said okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether he came to work for Wallace or what.
But I think there was a period when he was gone.
Maybe he ran around milked around Fred.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. If Oscar Scogan was there when you were and Bob Zeopelt, then I think the scandal came later.
No.
That happened while you were there?
I was there. Well,
you happened was, when, yeah. when was it, what was his wife's name? Bess or Bessie, or was the baby named Bessie when they finally...
That didn't sound like the name, though. Gee, what was her name?
Anyway, she seduced Bobsy.
Yeah.
And then he ran away.
Yeah, I think that,
But the tragic thing that, and then he and Scogan disowned his wife.
Yeah.
And the tragic thing is that baby got put in an orphanage or something.
Well.
Is what Scogan, we saw him a couple of years ago. Well, not too long ago. Maybe it was this May. Was it when you were in the hospital?
I don't remember.
I think it was when you were in the hospital with your hip replacement that Scogan and his wife.
Came down to the house.
No, they saw you in the hospital. We sat there in the hospital and talked.
Oh.
And after we talked a while, I said, you know, when we were having a good time, I said, maybe I shouldn't bring this up. I said, but, what, I'm beginning to put two and two together, I said, and I think that the person that was your wife is the one, and he picked up the story, and he said, yes, she was, and then he proceeded to tell the whole story.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But it was a mess.
Yeah, that was about the time when I was there. It was in that year, it was 41 or 42.
Well,
Bobby was the father.
Bobby was the father, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Scogan's wife got
pregnant.
Yeah.
Pregnant. And Scogan divorced her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then, well, what did he say about the child?
Ended up in an orphanage.
Then he feels...
Well, it wasn't his.
His ex-wife.
Yeah.
But I just felt sorry for the kid.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's a sad
I don't know. Maybe
thing.
Maybe the kid got adopted. I don't know.
Maybe it ended up all right. So.
Anyway, I've got it on tape somewhere, but it seemed to me it was a sad story.
Things happened even in the younger generation.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
40 years ago.
Yeah. Sure. And I was telling your dad when I was down there, and he thought that they hadn't did that, but they were boarding the herdsman upstairs there. And was it your, what, Effie? Or Effie?
Effie was there then, yeah.
Effie was there then, and she they did the cooking for the herdsmen and stuff. They stayed upstairs there.
Well, there were various, probably 3-4 hired men that lived upstairs.
Up there. Oh, oh.
Sometimes
see,
as many as...
the were there then. Bob Opelt lived up there, and Milton Kinchy, the one with the crippled hand.
Yeah.
He lived there.
How about Cleo? Cleo must have been there then, too, because the two of them, I thought, were there together. Cleo Reinfeldt or something like that?
Oh, say, there was a Reinfeldt there, too. Yeah. Sometime or other there. Yeah.
I think that they were together on the farm, so if Milton was there, why, you probably...
Yeah.
Cleo would have been there, too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Richard was there a while. That was what I can't figure out who left. Maybe that was when Bob Opelt left, that Red Richardson was in there some way or other. With those guys were herdsmen, and I think you only kept two then in the barn. See, taking that. But maybe there was three, because you did milk sometimes pretty early. I don't know. Maybe you did have them.
Well, I know the summer of 41, I hung around the barn, and that's when Billy Beadle was working there.
Oh,
he was 19.
Oh. And now, his father worked for you? So
I don't remember if...
came out there and helped some, didn't he?
Well, he was farm manager for...
That's right. Yeah.
And whether he was farm manager when Billy was there, I don't know.
But that name kind of sounded familiar. Now, maybe that was about the time that I left or something. Mm-hmm. But I remember...
Well, you stayed from January of 41 until how long?
Until March of 40... I stayed in 41. 42, see, mm-hmm. And then the next spring, like then, the spring of 43 was when I went back north.
So you were there a little over 2 years?
Yeah, a little over 2 years.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, Billy Beadle went from the farm into the Army.
Well, he was in college. He was working summer.
Yeah, sure.
And then he went to college, and then he went into the Army.
Yeah.
When Pearl Harbor came.
In 43 or something like that.
Summer of 41 was when he was in the barn.
Oh, yeah. Well, when he went into the Army, he was in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he was. He got killed.
And then I was telling Ronald the day, I was down there too, about the day that his dad bought a Dodge Dynafloat, they called him. And, of course, this was the automatic transmission that really you got now, but that was new.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they don't wouldn't hold just in low, you know. And he came up there to the hill or up to your farm, and I was doing chores there. They had some cows in the barn there, and I was out the water tank. There was a water tank, and it was on the other side of the barn there, mm-hmm. and the gate there. And his dad came up there, and he pulled up there with that car by your garage and kind of turned toward the barn and got out. Well, he started walking down that way, and all at once I noticed the car was starting to go. Well, I jumped over the gate, got up there, stopped it, come find out. He had to put it in park, see?
Mm-hmm.
He put it in low and thought that it would hold. Well, it just started off running down.
Could have run him down.
Yeah. But he was off to the side, kind of coming, you know?
Uh-huh.
And then we explained to him that was, you had to put that in there.
into park.
Yeah, mm-hmm. into park. That was...
Well, I should imagine the automatic transmission was a blessing for Grandpa, because he would drive in low, and he would drive in second.
Yeah.
And if it was automatic, then it would just...
Since you mentioned it, I remember that you had some of those old delivery trucks that had that on the back, you know, that was boxed-like, you know, and you had one that you used for on farm, and he'd get in that, and he'd put it in low, and here he'd come, you know, and oh, that thing would be just screaming, you know. He wouldn't change gears. Yeah, I suppose he thought he was in the other gear.
Well, know. He'd probably forget. He'd think he changed and couldn't hear.
Yeah,
it's a wonder that those vehicles survived.
Well, do you remember the Negro women that worked for us in the kitchen?
No. I didn't hear one.
I think Mrs. Cook was out there for a while.
She might have been, but Mrs. Bjork was there for a while, a Norwegian woman,
yes,
around that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure when Scotty came regularly. I think Scotty had been coming off and on, but she wrote it was before Grandpa died in 1949 that,
mm-hmm,
she would have been out there,
mm-hmm,
well before then. Because I think Dad was working up to saying how Scotty would drive with Grandpa. Was that what you were going to say?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What story were you going to tell?
Well, except that she'd know what he's doing wrong and tap him and show him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's old. Shift gears or whatever he had to do.
And he'd stop at the railroad track and say to Scotty, "Do you hear anything?" And she'd say no, and then they'd go across.
No, there was four of you children?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I kind of halfway remembered. You know, you were in school, and your dad or your mother would take you to school, I know, at that time.
Well, maybe once in a while, but there was a school cab that came around.
Yeah,
well, there weren't enough.
Then I don't think there was. Because
we rode it regularly.
Did you? Maybe they took you out to the road then.
They might have taken us out to the road when we were running late or something.
Yeah, that might be, yeah.
And because there was that little hill that went up,
yeah,
and the cab would come and sit at the end of the lane, and if we were running,
mm-hmm,
late, somebody might leap in the car and run,
yeah,
us down. But,
mm-hmm,
I don't remember that nearly as much as,
mm-hmm,
rushing to get to the top of that hill so they'd see we were coming.
Come and see you there.
And to wait for us.
Yeah.
And then George, the cab driver, would, you know, gripe and complain that we were slow. And,
yeah.
And
you
so
know, one day that my father was going to teach my mother to drive a car. She was going to drive a car. And then all of a sudden, we didn't hear any more about it. My mother didn't drive a car.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a long time before the story came out that mother was driving, my father was helping her, and Herrick got out on the road, and Grandma didn't stop, and the car ended sitting on top of the Herrick.
Oh.
Must have been traumatic for everybody involved, especially the heifer.
Yeah. So my father had to pay him for the heifer.
Yeah.
I don't know how the story ever got out, what happened.
How could, who would have told?
I don't know.
Maybe the farmer that sold the heifer.
Sold the heifer.
That had lost the heifer, because,
yeah,
I can't imagine either Grandma telling on herself or Grandpa telling on Grandma.
Well, anyway, I think that's a true story enough, though, because Grandma never did drive.
It would certainly explain why there was never any mention again of learning,
yeah,
to drive.
Yeah, I was going to show you that one picture here.
I'm asking if there's any,
yeah,
any memories of Grandpa.
Yeah. Well, I always remember after Robert Holmes had that runaway with that team that time, that little horse I was telling you about that would kick, she was kind of high life, and your dad, well, wasn't going to let us hook her up again until he was there, and he had Mr. Griffiths, and he had enough rope on that horse to tie her to every tree as we went by, and we got her out there, and he had a rope on her somewhere through the bridle so he could pull her head down, and we got her out there and hooked him up and went just a few ways. Mr. Griffiths says, "I think you better take the rope off. Rod can handle her now." And away we went. We used her.
I remember my father breaking horses out in front of the house.
Yeah.
I watched him there out in that circle between the house and the milk house.
Sure.
Breaking a horse.
Yeah,
when I was just a little kid.
I remember having him have a long rope on them, and they would circle around and around and,
mm-hmm,
around, and finally be able to get up to them and gentle them.
No, otherwise, I don't remember.
I don't think there were any parades and floats then. It was during the war, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah,
probably they weren't,
yeah,
doing,
that's
things
right,
like that.
Yeah, I forgot that was during the war, because I remember I had, you had to turn in your surplus tires and stuff, and I had a few extra tires, they weren't good, but I could use, and they came out with that thing that you were only allowed five tires, and you had to turn the others in, you know, they made you turn those in.
I had no time during the war to get enough, but tickets to buy gas.
Gas, yeah, sure.
Run my trucks. And I'd spend every Sunday counting up these coupons.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Well, what did you do about the war?
I went in and I was branded for F because I had a hernia. And they didn't take me. They wouldn't take you then. That before that, they had operated on a few and it didn't work out. And they wouldn't take you. And then I never had any more trouble with a hernia. I knew I had a slight one when I was in high school, taking physicals and stuff. But never did anything about it. And so they branded me 4F, and they wouldn't take you. And so then I came back, and I never did anything with it until the year that I moved here. I went down to Badger Ordnance and was going to work part-time down there. And the old doctor scared me out. He said, minister, he said, you know you're taking chances with your life? He said, that could strangulate and kill you. Boy, I came home and I went and had to take care of
him. Badger Ordnance, what road is that on?
That's on 12.
Well,
Highway 12.
And what town was it near?
What was your specific job on the farm? Were you in the barn or were you general farm?
I worked a lot on the farm, out on the farm doing just like with horses working. We did all other work like hauling stuff with hay and stuff. We hauled with the horses then. Mm-hmm. And then I was kind of a relief guy too. I would go in the barn and help out like if they were short. And then I also worked in the dairy some too.
Never peddled any milk.
No. That was what. That was the reason I left you, was because I wanted one of those milk routes and I never could get one. Yeah, that was the reason I left.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Red Holmes was on.
Yeah,
one of them.
He got one after I left.
Yeah.
Yeah. Robert got one after I left. Yeah.
Benny Harder quit us. He went to work for Red Wagon.
Yeah, I knew that.
Because he wanted a milk route.
Oh, and you didn't have one for him.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear the, did you watch the,
series?
Oh, there at one
time. Just a minute. Yeah. Grandpa's saying that they took a lot of chances having bulls when I mentioned the WJ saying, is he singing, Rodney? Okay, go on.
I remember one bull. We had to have an older bull in there and a young bull. The young bull was awfully feisty, and the big bull didn't have anything to do with him, but he finally got mad at the young bull, and he slammed into him. He knocked him against the fence so hard that it just took the wind right out of him. And that young bull never bothered that old bull again.
No.
Was the cow tester crushed on our farm or on somebody else's farm?
No, not on our farm.
Rashke.
No.
No, he was the one that was coming to your farm when I was there, but that must have happened just after.
Wasn't he the one that got crushed?
Yeah,
because he was crippled.
Yeah.
In the first place.
Well, sure.
He was crippled in the first place.
He was the one that used to come there. I forgot about that.
But I don't think that happened. No. Because I'd have employer's insurance at that time,
mm-hmm.
And I collected quite a lot on a few injuries that I had, but nothing on Rashke.
So somewhere else he was killed, wasn't he?
Ooh.
Crowded against the side of a pen and killed?
No, I don't think he was killed, but he, no. But I don't even remember now how serious it was, but he really Lady Bumpy.
Isn't it funny how a name, when you mentioned that right away,
yeah.
I never thought about that until you mentioned right away. That kind of rang a bell.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was a little crippled guy.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Doc Nylund used to come down, too, from Janesville.
Well, he was a veterinarian.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember who it might have been, him. Oh, I think I had that down there, you were involved with that bull farm over there going toward Janesville. I used to go over there once in a while. You'd send me over there to help out, you know, to kind of, one of those fellows who run short out. And then we'd go down to the Beloit Ironworks then. You'd have us take that truck and go down and get shavings and take out to them out there at the that wool farm.
Well, now this was where you were keeping the bulls at first, the artificial insemination bulls.
Rock County Breeders Co-op.
Rock County Breeders Co-op. Kept their bulls there on the Janesville Road for a while.
I was a treasurer down there when we organized that.
Mm-hmm.
And Markham was in that. And
And this was before you bought from ABS, before ABS was...
ABS didn't have any when it started.
It was just starting, just beginning about then.
We were the first
premiers that
wholesale customer of Rock Prentice.
What'd you do? Give up your bulls that you had then?
Oh yeah.
Uh-huh.
After we were able to get everything we needed from ABS.
Mm-hmm.
They only had 3 Guernsey bulls at first.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sent us down bull semen about 3 times a week. There was no preservation of it at that time, no freezing of it. And then they put on all seam bulls, and then we had all seam on that. Well, I furnished some bulls for that co-op. And Wallace furnished a New Jersey bull and so forth. But,
I've always kind of tried to pick up where that place was at, up along that road going to Janesville, because my daughter lives way over on the west side out in the country, and we come over and come across, and we come down and then go up to the hospital right up through there somewhere, but I never could spot where that...
I wouldn't be able to spot it.
I said that.
Spent a lot of time down there.
Yeah, I remember that. You had to go up quite a grade to get up in there, and you went by the house, and the barn was right in the back there.
I don't think we had any insurance against the bull damaging.
No.
Maybe we must have.
Yeah.
But I know the neighbors didn't like to have a bull farm right there. We weren't making enough money down there to really keep going.
No. Well, I think that was the reason that you sent them some help over once in a while.
Yeah,
that kind of,
I know.
Keep them moving.
We had to put on a hot water heater, and it cost $100. We got it from Sears. It took us about 3 months to pay for it before. Sears got quite impatient with us, so we had.
I said, I tell my kids about how hard times were then, and it's kind of hard for them to believe.
It's hard to believe, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's hard to believe that in the early 40s that you could live on 60 a month.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And that those were good wages.
Yeah, they were good wages because we doubled our wages, and that's what my brother-in-law said, Robert Holmes. He said, Jay even doubled what he was getting because down there. And it just was unbelievable. But I was buying gas, I think then 7 gallons for a dollar. 7 gallons for a dollar.
Well, I remember going up to back in Otis Store, and I don't know when it was, but nobody was on the place was getting more than...
It was 32 or 33. It was back in the Depression. Yeah.
And I went up to Janesville on a train. It took about 2 hours to get up there, so that sort of trucked along. I was trying to figure out how we could possibly raise wages. Because I didn't think a married man could live on less than $100 a month. And I couldn't figure out how I could ever do it and stay in business.
Yeah.
And finally, pulling into Janesville, I tore up the envelope I was working on and said to myself, well, I'm going to do it anyway. So everybody was raised to $100 a month.
But then you see, you must have cut back. You must have cut back at some point for Rodney to be getting 60 in 1941.
Maybe
we're forced to by the...
See, we got a little, there was a little leeway to get a little raise there, because then, I don't know, just remember what I was getting, but, you know, we got a little $5 a raise once in a while, you know.
But at Gay's Mill, you were just getting 30, huh?
30, right.
New boy.
Yeah, I was milking cows night and morning and doing farm work.
You think that was when I decided to raise everybody to 100, that was in the correction?
You told me that, but you maybe got it wrong. I've got it in my notes from long ago, and put it in the depression. But maybe that's far too high.
Haven't you got the wage or is a gap in your record of employees and what they earned?
We've got books, but we've got one missing book, and then I think that the book that I brought along doesn't give wages in it, does it?
No.
I think it's just the workbook.
Yeah. No, boy, we were tickled to death, because I had talked to Earl Bounds when he was up there about getting in down your place, and he actually arranged for me to come down for an interview with you folks and your dad, you, to get a job. So, you know, came down, and, well, my brother-in-law was in Clinton, Edward Hedge. He brought me down, he drove down. Well, I talked to Geneva every little once in a while.
Oh.
Probably not lately. I don't know why we stopped, but once a week, Tuesday night, for a long time, she used to call up.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, the girl has been in a bad way for a long time.
Yeah, he died.
Geneva.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And Minerva.
See, I didn't know her. I didn't know.
Was her name Minerva?
The sister.
Minerva. Yeah,
the sister was
right.
Minerva,
I think
right?
It was, yeah. But I didn't know her. I knew her folks. They lived at Mount Zion.
Something built with it.
Finns and Danes and.
Grandpa's talking about the American Scandinavian Foundation in New York that reports Norwegians, Swedes, Finns, Danes,
so forth, and places them in jobs in this country.
Oh, I see.
And
we're talking to Quentin Bowen.
The jobs or anything, they'll shop, put them in Fairbanks or Morris, or they'll put them in a foundry here, or a manufacturing place somewhere else, but 300 or 400 a year, and still doing it. And I've had about, on our farm, then they had a division of agricultural workers. Now these are pretty well educated young people, at least equivalent of a couple of years of high school anyway. Some of them a great deal more. And I'd had probably 15 of them all together, and they come and stay on my place for a year, and that was all mine then. And then they would go on to California. California was the mecca of all these Norwegians and Swedes and so forth. They wanted to see California. So they'd work out there for 6 months or a year, and then back to Norway. And I was having to see the woman that I corresponded with in New York about these trainees.
Candy?
Guess so. I'm a sucker for Kit Kats. Want a Kit Kat?
So now I got some new teeth. I whistle with them.
Okay, well, go on, Dad.
Anyway, she wanted to come out, and she was making a survey of some of the places that were handling these people, and she was going to come to Boyd and wanted to see me. And I knew her name, and I forgot it now, but it was an Italian name, working for the Scandinavian Foundation. And when she stepped off the train at Beloit, here was a 5 foot, 1 inch, slim little Italian girl, and running a whale of a job. And so I met her, and then I put her in the car, and we talked a while, and I go to take her at the farm and see what we had. And I got thinking, God, how am I going to take care of this girl? I got it here for at least 6 or 8 hours. I know who can handle it. Help me. Al Bowen. So I went out to Al's, talking to the girl. I told her that I had this friend that was a great inventor and interested conversationalist, and she'd be tickled to death to meet him. And she went along with me, and so we went out to Al's, and he gave us the trip, you know, in his Jeep.
Yeah.
Uphill and down Dale, and talking every minute, and she asking questions, and talking about the various things that he was interested in doing, and she thought she would stump him. And she said, Mr. Bowen, there's so much talk about fluorinating water now, and that's all right for the towns, and big towns, and even medium-sized towns, but what about the poor chap out in the country that's just got a well? He's got water to the house, water to the barn. Couldn't you invent something that you could put on the faucet and, ha-ha, he ran into the house and brought out the blueprints of some, I'm about to get this in, about to get the papers on this thing.
He was pretty full of ideas. He invented that hose boy too, you know.
Yeah.
But he sold that to somebody, and I don't think they ever promoted it, but I think good. Well, I didn't get out of 8th grade. Never did.
Quentin is saying he didn't have any education. I didn't get out of 8th grade. You did all right.
Yeah. But, so after I got in the big theater...
Well, it's been sitting in front of you.
Have you got enough there?
Yeah, I finished mine.
Okay.
Go on.
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
After you got out of the theater.
I just went into Rockford, and I just went from one theater to the next. I played until I finally ended up in the Coronado. And I was a 3-year contractor, first trumpeter in the Chicago, in the Coronado Theater Orchestra. That was a big deal in those days. We had big vaudeville shows, we had Eddie Cantor, and the era along with those big shows came to town.
Mm-hmm.
We thought we were doing real great. And then talking pictures came. And a traveling leader from Hollywood came and stayed about 3 months with us at the Coronado, and we developed shows and that sort of thing. And his wife, my wife, and I were just going to his apartment. Have good times. He told me, he says, you'll be out of this business in about 3 years, he says, because I'm telling you, he says, the talking pictures and color are both on the way. And it'll be about 3 years and all these big theaters across the country will be switched over to picture houses with sound and everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, Gladys and I had talked about it. I have to get this in there. I had a marvelous wife, smart girl. And I decided to take a course in public accounting by correspondence. So that next morning, after that night that we were out, I'd been thinking about it. She'd been wanting me to do it all the time, but she hated the music business. She just didn't have any respect for that kind of a business at all. So I took that course, and it took me 3 years to finish it. So he was absolutely right. 3 years, we all got laid off. All across the country, thousands of musicians and stagehands and operators, everybody got laid off.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a diploma in public accounting that I got by correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
So then I started going around to all the factories in Rockford, and everybody knew me because they'd seen me down in this pit, don't you know?
Mm-hmm.
They'd heard me play and their dances and all this stuff. Everybody knew me, but nobody would give me a job. They said, well, Quinn, we can get certified public accountants for $25 a week. Depression was on, 1933, 32, So I had this diploma and all that, but I couldn't get a job. So then I went out selling counting machines for Underwood Elliott Fisher Company on a straight commission basis. And I did that for 11 years. I ended up, I was 11th highest in counting machine sales in the United States. Well, then another war came along, 1942, and they wouldn't sell machines or ship machines unless you were making ammunition or things for the war effort. So then I was out again because I was a straight commission salesman. So I went out to Sunstrand, and the secretary and treasurer out there was a nice man. I just sat down by the desk and told him what a predicament I was in, you know. I just a heck of a mess. So he said, well, Quinn, you come to work for Sunspan. We'll give you a job. Well, I took a great big cut from what I was making. Just a mess. But anyway, he put me in the production department of the Sunstrand pump division. And in about 3 months, I was factory manager of the hydraulic division, and then we started the aviation division. And I and a bunch of guys, we put the first aviation drive together. And I was doing the production work, getting the parts all ready and getting everything ready, and the guys put it together, and then that's the beginning of Sunstrand Aviation. Mm-hmm. I stayed with them 27 years. And when I retired, I was works manager, or not works manager, there's a difference, a factory manager of three plants, one in Denver, Colorado, the South Rue and the Rockford plant, the big one out there. So I did all right.
Quinn, whatever just happened
if you'd gone through high school and college, you might have ended up as president of the United States.
No,
if you did that on an eighth grade education.
I don't know. I'm sure I don't know, but whatever happened.
Well, look what a head start he got, though, by starting work when he was 15 years old.
Oh, I was going to tell you and Jackie that the Dugan farm business is of such an interest to me because it is the very first job that my brother Alfred or I ever had. See, we lived on a farm with my father and mother and the family, and of course that was a job and we worked like the dickens. But to go out and get a check for working for somebody.
My first check.
I'm making a record here and I hope it's...
It's all right.
I'm not can't tell any lies. And, so that, the Dugan farm was the first check that Alfred had ever got or I ever got from anybody. And I think we learned a lot on that job out there. I think we got a start.
Mm-hmm.
And we learned, I know I learned a lot of things because we enjoyed it. Could you understand my write-up?
Yeah, I've got questions to ask you about it.
Oh, so.
And,
well then now quit talking and you ask me questions.
No, just keep on, and then when you come to a break, then I'll...
Well, and my wife and I got married in 1925 when I was playing in the Midway Theater. And she was a kind of a, you might say, an orphan girl. She had lots of aunts and uncles, and she was the only child in this whole group. Well, her dad wasn't feeling well, so he was a printer at the Republic. So they decided they would move to California for his health. And on the trip out there, her mother got pneumonia, and her mother died in California. Then her father picked up the housekeeper, and they couldn't get along. So my wife then went with one of her bachelor uncles who lived in Rockford. And then he died, and her aunts died, everybody died. This poor girl, one of them even committed suicide. She had to go home and find one aunt. So she was really in a heck of a mess, but she's a beautiful, sweet girl. So I said, well, let's get married now. I I was living in a town near by the English Harold Ballroom. I had a room. Mm-hmm. I was playing the theater. And I needed a home. I needed somebody to love me too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we got married, and I had to get my mother to come down from Beloit and go to the courthouse so I could get a license. And Gladys was 18 and I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
And so then she got a job then as a bookkeeper in a lumber yard, and she did real good. And we just proceeded to save our money and build and build and build and build. And then we bought a nice home and moved into that. And then I got the bug to buy a place out on Springbrook Road. I don't know where it is in Rockford there. But we bought 5 acres out there and built a gorgeous ranch.
That's out of Rockford.
Yeah, in the woods there.
I was on that road yesterday.
There's a guy, a fellow's building a big, big castle on there now. Did you see that? It's got 17 bathrooms and it's costing $2 million. That's on our my property, where our home was. So what I was leading up to was that I was always building something like bird baths and stuff. We never bought anything much. I'd always get some stuff together and pour some concrete and make a bird bath, you know, put rocks around it and like mm-hmm. that. And I found an old butter crock from the Dugan farm. A chip, a half of one, but it said the Dugan farm on it. And I put mold of that in this bird bath down there. I was wondering if that bird bath is still there.
Tell me where it is and I'll go see.
4949 Springbrook Road.
Okay, we got it on the tape. 4949 Springbrook Road. I'll go see.
The lady's name is Mrs. Fry. F-R-Y.
Now, is this the castle they're building there?
Well, this is after Gladys died. I sold the whole property, the whole 5 acres, the home and all, to this man, Mr. Fry.
Mm-hmm.
And in the contract, I had it in there that he couldn't subdivide it without permission, because I was on a contract at the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he came up along and wrote me a letter and said he had a chance to sell 2.5 acres out of that plot. And of course, I won't tell you the price because that's maybe I shouldn't, but it was fabulous. You never could believe how much he offered for that piece of ground. So
More than you paid for it anyway.
I paid five.
I say more than you paid for it.
I paid $5,000 for the whole acre, you see.
Reminds me of my father wanting to buy a farm east of us. And he wrote to his, this was 1920, and he wrote to his, called his banker, Larry Clinton, and he said, I can see where I could pay $500, $50 an acre for that place, but they want 60. And the banker said, I take it for 60, I think, make it pay up $60 an acre. And it changed hands a couple of times before we got it. I mean, my father operated it, and then he gave it to my brother, and then my brother sold it to me. And when I sold it, I got $750 of an acre for it. I mean, it's climbed that way. And I suppose that's good sentence.
Well, they've subdivided it and sold it to houses.
If you shut that off, I'll tell you how much we sold that place.
So, well, tell me about when you were coming down. Were you saying something finishing up about this property?
No, well, the only thing was that I was down there alone, and I only have the one son, and Bud, and they were way up here, and Bud and Pat said, why don't you come up here, you know, but Rockford don't mean anything to you now anymore, your mom's gone, and of course you got lots of friends and all that, but come on up. So I came up and looked it over. I'd never been here before. I thought it was a pretty area, nice, beautiful place. The river goes through here and there's everything, and I'm a farm boy anyway. And So they said, "What's it? I'll design the house, and I know all of the furniture. I'll have it all, put it all together for you," which he did. And I just moved up bag and baggage, and I built a warehouse down in the back of the barn. There's a nice warehouse down there, and I hauled it. Hold all my stuff and put it in the warehouse. That was the warehouse is just packed with stuff. In fact, there's half of it still down there, you know.
And it looks like you're totally busy, that you keep yourself, you know, you don't have time to do all your projects.
I got so much to do, I can't go anyplace, you know, hardly. And all I do is I take care of the chickens. We got about 75 chickens down there in the chicken house.
The geese, though.
I don't touch the geese, though. That's not my project. But I feed the chickens and I gather the eggs.
That's it. I'm not going to eat any more candy.
And that's what my job is. Mm-hmm. No, now you, that's about all I can tell you. But I thought it was kind of interesting about that butter crock that's in that bird bath.
I'll go see it. I'll go see if it's there. It's going to be on the property somewhere, huh?
Yeah, when you go in the driveway, there's a back door. First thing you come when you go right away is the nice front door.
This is the house you lived in, not the palace they're building.
No.
Okay. The palace is on the other 2.5 acres.
Go in my office in a couple of minutes, and I'll show you pictures of it so you can feel at home. And I just thought, it would be kind of nice if that old bird bath is still down there. And what happened was there was a stump. We cut down a great big trees to build a house. There was a stump up this big around. So this cement bed bath I made right on the top of the stump, you know.
Well, the woman is in the house now that you told her, you give her.
Her name is Fra.
Right. She bought the house from you.
Yeah. We're a good friend.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Well, I go down to the bird bath.
We called the house Bonniewood because my mother and father called our farm in western Minnesota Bonniewood. Mother had a Scotch inheritance some way back in line, and she liked the word bonny, you know, it's a bonny day and all that stuff. And they liked our farm so much we called it Bonniewood. So then when we bought that woods down Rockland, you know, I called it Bonniewood. Mm-hmm. And so I told Gladys, wrote a nice little few words in one of the books that I had over here. She said something to the words that she hoped nothing ever changed the beauty of Bonniewood. And this lady, Mrs. Fry, she made a needlepoint of it. My wife's student. She's got it on the wall there, she said.
I'll go look at it.
Well, anyway, and she's wonderful people. He sells boats. He's on the road a lot. He might not be home, but but he sells boats all over Wisconsin and all over.
Well, I won't see her this trip, but one of these times when I come down, if it's good weather, I'll bicycle, and if it isn't good weather, I'll drive down and see her.
Well, why don't we go in my office so I can show you a few things?
Okay, unless we want to talk some more.
Okay, go on, take it.
Let's see, I read your account with interest, and I wondered what happened to your sister Merrill when they got to Beloit.
Oh.
You mentioned that she and your mother, and you boys went out to the farm. What happened to your mother and Merrill?
Well, they stayed. Merrill.
Merrill, okay.
They stayed with my sister in Orfordville on the country farm for a few months, but of course that wasn't so good. So mother had a couple $1,000 left over from the farm that when she closed out and had auction and all that stuff. So mother built a house in Beloit on Randall Street. Did you know the Smiths, Elizabeth's mother and father?
No.
Well, they had a home on Randall Street. And mother, my brother-in-law that's married to my sister, is a carpenter. So he built a house there, and then mother and Merle lived in that house and lived in Beloit.
Mm-hmm.
And all this, while they were living there, I was rooming in Rockford, you see. So that, then mother and Merle Alfred took my sister Merle down to New York with him, and she met a man down there and married a guy from New Jersey. So then Mother went to New Jersey too. We sold the house in Beloit.
Okay, now when did you come to the farm?
Oh, I don't know. You probably know better than that.
Well, you said 1922. You were 17. How old were you? What was the year when you were 17?
I was born in 05.
So that would have been 22, and you stayed about how long?
Gosh, I don't know. I was trying to think out whether I was there a whole year or longer or shorter.
Okay, here's January of 1922. Leon Richardson, Wallace Milo, Ted Selmer, Joseph Gere, Hubert Rogan, Robert Alder, you mentioned Robert Alder, Lester Stamm, and Elsa Smith. Let's see if we can see where the Bowens show up. If you stayed a year and you were 17.
I'm born in 1902.
And you said that the boys were gone. Here's John Tomlinson, Dad.
Yeah, I know. He said they were there for the summer.
Yeah, and so were you. Ronald Dogan was working that summer.
You were in Paris, you son.
Well, not yet.
Well, what year were you in Paris?
23.
Let's go to 23 then.
June of 23 to June of 24.
You and your brother. I didn't get to see either one of them. Either one of you fellas.
My brother's dead.
Oh, you think?
About 3 years ago.
Your mother and father too, I suppose. Yeah.
Now Vera. Hmm? And now my wife.
Yeah. How long were you married?
64 years.
Gosh, I thought we'd been married a long time. We're 58 years together. That's terrible, isn't it?
Keep looking around or wondering if you want to ask something. Do you remember when or something like that? At least you're the only one who knows anything about it.
Can't you find where the Bowens got her? You were in there at all?
Well, you've got to be in there.
You've got to
be in there. Here's 23. November, let's see. Here we come. You began the 12th of November, 1923.
Okay.
Quentin Bowen, or Alfred Bowen began the 12th, and Quentin Bowen too.
Yeah.
How much did he get?
$40.
Together or a piece?
Well, that was the first month. Let's see what you got the second month.
I thought I got $35 a month.
Okay, Quentin Bowen, well, that first month you would have started early, and so here's Quentin Bowen. You got $25.33 the first month, and Alfred got 27 because he worked...
One more day or something.
Well, that's strange. Maybe he got paid a little more than you did.
18th, 12th.
I'd have been mad about it if I'd have known it.
18th day.
Yeah, and see, but he's...
Let's take the next one.
Okay, the next one here is... Quentin was getting 40 a month and Al was getting 40 a month.
Well, then I was wrong. All I
can remember. So you both got 40 a month and you began the 12th of November, 1923. And let's see, you were there into 24. Let's see, here's May of 24. I think that we've lost you.
Time goes by and you get so close.
Glenn Guile.
Here we are, January of 24. Quentin Bowen was still there. Well, you would have been there for November, January, February. Oh, come, you must have stayed longer than that.
I can't believe that. I have to believe it, but I can't figure it out.
November of 23, December of 23, January of 24, but February of 24, you're missing.
Well, I've heard that. That probably was the end of it.
March and...
I got married in 25, and how could I have done all those other things after that? Well, I'm not going to try to figure it out now.
Yeah. Well, anyway, you're here.
Yeah, I'm here.
You're in the book. And
your first, checks were $40 range.
Yeah.
Well, they had board and room too.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
How did it? Well, nobody else was getting much more than that. Sam was getting $65.
But he wasn't living in the, well, he had the other house, didn't he, at that time? Yeah. Well, let's see, what else did we,
there, except what I made for the table.
When you were there, they didn't make it, no.
Well, I started that after I was running the dairy.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Then did you live in the farm there?
There's a little house east of the dairy.
East of the milk house,
now,
the one you mentioned.
That's where Lester used to live. What? I think that's where Lester lived when I was
there.
Or
else Lester's parents.
Well, anyway, I moved into that house in 1924. Yeah, no, 1924. No, from 1925. I lived in Roy for a while. Went to Roy College after I was married. And that's when your tuition at a place like Roy College was something like $300 a check. Now they're charging $9,000 or something like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's where I live.
What's your line of work?
I teach writing and
you're
literature.
Teaching writing, huh?
Yeah.
Oh.
And
good. We got the right guy working on this. Huh?
Try to get my I've got a book you see written right a lot written on the farm, but I haven't gotten it published yet except in the Beloit Daily News. We had quite a bit in there. I should see that you get some of those.
I think I got it here someplace. Beloit Daily News.
Yeah, I remember Dad mentioning that you worked on the Dogan Farm, and I said, well, we ought to get in touch with him. And then the next thing I knew, Phyllis Gunderson had...
I suppose that operation that I was trying to describe in that milk house, I suppose that's all gone, huh? That bottling machine and all that?
Oh, the machinery's all gone. And the building is, I sold the farm.
Yeah, I understand.
And the buildings are, the house is the big house and that little house.
Well, before this machine stopped, I don't think we missed anything on the farm, but Clinton was saying that he liked every job that he'd ever had, the farm and the music and the...
This is 50.
I told Dad that you remembered the important thing that's on the silo, which is the life as well as a living sort
still
of thing.
There.
It's still there, yeah, and it's been freshened up over the years so that it's still very clear. And the barn is falling down around it, but the silo is still staunch, except that it got a crack in it when the first time that they brought the wet silage down from Libby up at Janesville. And there was so much water pressure in there, which there wasn't ordinarily, that the thing cracked. And so they had a sort of race against time they quit putting the silage in and then went out and got some bands that were on those wooden slat silos and put the bands around it. And that saved the silo, didn't it?
Well, it didn't go any farther.
It didn't go any further.
Yeah.
So that was there, and then you were talking about the dining room table, and which I, of course, ate at many's the time and enjoyed. And you said that you talked about Grandpa's roll-top desk in the front room of the house. There wasn't a room there, was there, where the men sat directly east of the dining room? You'd have to come in, and there was two sort of parlor rooms. And the end one was where Grandpa had his desk.
The end one?
Yeah. But the men didn't have a sitting room that...
No, I don't remember that the men sat there after dinner.
That was built on much later.
Yeah, well, sometime between 1923 and when I was a little girl, because it was there from the time I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
so it would have been built on within the next 8 or 10 years. Yeah. And do you remember a rug? Was there a red rug? Because various people have said that they'd come and stand on that rug in front of Grandpa's desk.
I don't remember.
But that. I had to laugh at your story of asking for a raise and not getting it, but being made to feel better about it.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Arthur was a salesman too.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Very much so.
And then you lived up over the milk house.
Yeah.
And that later became, it was an apartment and so forth, but it became the office. For the dairy for a long time, and it ended up as the office, didn't it? And then the round barn, of course. Let's see. Okay. And then what I was impressed with was how much you identified with the work. That you were in there fighting the battle of the.
I liked the work. Mm-hmm. I took an interest in it.
But you took personal responsibility for seeing that that milk was clean.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was part of your own crusade and not just Grandpa's.
He talked me into it, though, don't you know?
Okay, he talked you into
it. He explained to me that it was necessary.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to do a good job.
Well, that's obvious, and
always try to do that no matter what I get me to do. I try to do it as best I could.
And I loved what your father said about dropping a silver dollar in a bucket of Holstein milk. You could still read "In God We Trust."
You want to know?
Yeah, yeah. Let's see. And then you talked about Grandpa being the top of the organization, which he was, and watched everything like a hawk, which he did.
Were you aware of all of that certified milk deal and how we developed it and all that out there before you got my letter?
Well, I knew that
this idea of no milking machines and all that kind of thing.
Well, they used the milking machines later on.
Oh, I suppose.
So, but at the time you were there, they were milking by hand, uh-huh. Right?
Yeah.
How many were in the barn milking? Do you remember?
I don't know.
Two, three, four?
About four, I think.
About four. So Al was milking then.
I think he
was in the barn.
He was more of an outdoors man. He worked in the fields and he did all this stuff. Mm-hmm.
But you were in the milk house and doing the bottling and things.
My full job was in that mm-hmm. milk house.
I'm interested in the Bible reading at the table because some of the men that I have talked to remember it and others don't. And so I'm sure that and when I was little, I don't remember him doing it, and I think that maybe he had stopped it by then.
Maybe
but
so.
But I know that the fellow that talked to us that was there in 1917 and 18 said that went on, and I think when Jim Howard was there, when they gathered at the Ford, mm-hmm. that went on. Would the men be respectful, or would they be
respectful.
Anxious
sure they
to go, or?
Well, they wanted to go, but they didn't. Well, they knew better.
Would he be very long, or would he take a short passage to read and explicate?
Well, I would think that the session probably lasted 30, 40 minutes at the most.
That's fairly long.
Fairly long. Quite long.
After a hard day's work.
Yeah.
And everybody's sitting at the table.
We had our dinner and we sat around there.
Mm-hmm. Probably did you all good.
Fellas used to do a few tricks, little things that I probably shouldn't tell.
Oh, please tell. Those are the kinds of things I want that liven things up.
I told you about how we separated the milk that he didn't sell in town. We separated it and we got the cream.
Uh-huh.
And Grandpa Dugan wouldn't let us have cream on our oatmeal.
Uh-huh.
We had, because he said it wasn't healthy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That milk was, whole milk was the thing to use, so. Once in a while, I'd get a little bottle of that cream, you know, and put it in my blouse. Then we'd eat on the table, and those guys would sneak it out.
And here. You don't remember what they called skimmet.
Skimmet?
That was at a different time. The skimmet, yeah. Which was the froth that came like almost like whipped cream, but it was the froth really from skim milk, wasn't it?
From the separator.
From the separator, yeah. So you would sneak the cream in then?
Yeah, I didn't do it very often, mm-hmm. but.
Oh, I mean, there was none of those.
I told the Ford story. Go on. The men were respectful.
Respected uh-huh. the family and all. They mm-hmm. were all glad they had the job, you mm-hmm. know.
So they would sit for that 30 or 40
sure.
minutes and
sure.
more or less pay attention. And
he controlled it. I mean, he sat till he was done.
Well, he considered it his duty to do this and to have a moral influence on the young men under his care.
Yeah. Well, Al told me, and he had his tongue in his cheek when he did, that you answered an ad in the Daily News that Grandpa had for men.
That's
and
right.
in the ad, you wanted men that didn't smoke and didn't drink
That's
and
right.
were preferably Methodists. That's what happened. But the
well, we didn't smoke and we didn't drink and we were Methodists. We belonged to Methodist Church in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Did you have Y memberships? I understood that Grandpa saw to it that everybody had a Y membership and could go down and use the Y
No, that must have been later on.
Uh-huh. Or maybe earlier and he discontinued it. And did you have ways of getting into town? Were there bicycles and things?
No, we walked a good most of the time. Well, I suppose
mm-hmm.
we caught a ride when somebody was going in or something.
Mm-hmm.
There was one young man there, and I can't think of now what his name was or anybody. He was the runner that I keep talking about.
Yeah, we were wondering about that.
Well, he is a young punk, and of course I was a young punk too, but he was... He didn't have any special job there except to run errands and do stuff like that.
Ed Paff?
No. Is he there?
Ed Paff's on the list.
He was
a sort of a young punk at that time.
And he and Esther. What happened to Esther?
She died.
Let's see, just a minute. Let's get this person first. It wouldn't have been Claire Matthews. And it wouldn't have been Lester. It might have been Ed. How about Walter Lake?
No, you see, none of those names except Lester is the only one.
Stuart Brown?
Anyway, he had a little Ford with a special body on it, a little racer body on it. I wonder.
Sounds like Ed Paff. He had to go out of business as a handyman, and Model T Fords were discontinued.
Oh.
He knew the inside of a Model T Ford. He could do anything with it.
Could have been the guy, all right.
Well, let's see, there was Ted Selmer when you first came, and Glenn Guile, and Wolf von Trutschler, Jacob Krusey, they're getting more money, though, Henry Levy, Eldon Russell, or Selden Russell, and Quentin and Alfred, Claire Matthews, Ed Paff. I bet you Ed Paff was the...
I bet it was, too.
Was the runner there.
It doesn't ring a bell at all.
We used to call him Yardbird.
Oh.
he's there consistently while you're there.
Okay.
That might have been him. But, let's see, what were we saying about him? What were we saying about...
I just said he was a runner.
Oh, and then you asked about Esther.
He's the guy who carried the milk up the...
Mm-hmm.
The
runner guy was a suspect. Well,
I don't know enough about it.
According to the story, he's the one that reported to Grandpa that Peters was coming across the roof.
Oh.
And Peters beat him up the next
day.
So that sounds it sounds like Ed Paff.
Yeah, sure.
Because Ed Paff's the one that the story is that he reported on that.
Well, anyway.
And
of course, I was a young punk too, but they never questioned me at all. But I thought, my God, I'm around here too, don't you know?
But you were gone before.
But I must have been
before
gone
that.
Before that happened.
Yeah.
Didn't they fix her up in a little? She married this guy, and they went up the road a little bit.
They were at Chopia.
Oh, was that it? I heard that's what happened.
Yeah. And. She worked around and had the store, the general store at Chopier for a number of years.
Oh.
And actually had quite a few marriages.
She was cute, and she was fun to have around.
I'm sure. Yeah.
She was full of hell, and she'd come around there and come around the milk house, and you know how kids are, and squirt water at you and stuff like that. Raise little hell.
Yeah. Well, she had a hard
all
life.
All harmless, but
she had a hard life, and in this day and age, the things she did, in the first place, there would have been birth control.
Yeah, sure.
So that she wouldn't have gotten into trouble.
And people wouldn't have thought a thing about it.
And in the second place, if she had gotten into trouble, why, Grandma wouldn't have disowned her, which Grandma did, because she said bad seed, you know, and so forth. She was a foster child. And so they found out then that the mother had run off with somebody else, and the father had put the children in.
Just a little bad blood in there.
And so that's what Grandma said, you see. She was convinced it was bad blood, and there was nothing that could be done, and so forth. And so Grandpa's, all his inclinations were to have Esther back and so forth, but Grandma wouldn't have it, and Grandpa really couldn't fly in the face of Grandma. I think Grandma was jealous of Esther, too, because she was so pretty and so charming.
I remember she was a nice-looking girl, and I remember she was full of fun, you know?
Uh-huh.
It's like any teenage kid, you know? They like to have fun, that's all. And, of course, she'd come over and see what I was doing and talk and all that. Kid around, but that was all.
Well, she would have been some 3 years younger than you, or four.
I suppose.
If you were 17, she would have been 13 or 14.
Yeah, that's the way I remember.
Because she's the same, Eloise is six-some years younger than you, and she was the same age as Eloise Marston down the road.
I knew she, I hadn't mentioned it, but I knew she was an adopted daughter or something of the kind. She wasn't adopted, though.
They made a mistake. They should have adopted her. Now, maybe they couldn't. I don't know. Maybe the parents, the father had never given her up for adoption. But I think if they had adopted her, she would have felt more as if she was actually belonging. And and also, it would have been harder for Grandma to
she couldn't
disown her.
Disown her so easy.
And so the relationship continued in future years, but fitfully, you know. It was never...
Well, that's too bad.
Yeah. So
I don't think I can tell you anything more about.
Well, just a minute. Let me look along here and see what other comments I made. Can you remember any other stories involving Grandpa? Anything he said or anything he did or?
No, I can't. I tell you, I laid awake one night and I thought about all this stuff and I just sat down and wrote it all and it's about as complete as I could make it.
You said that Grandma had time to listen to your thoughts and needs, and that's a nice thing to hear, because I didn't know that Grandma took time to listen to people's thoughts and needs.
She did. And she was talking about her boys, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you'd sit out in the kitchen maybe and chat with her while she worked sometimes?
I never got in the kitchen, but I sat around that dining table. Breakfast table. Mm-hmm. See, breakfast was a spotty thing, and then I had a chance to visit her a little bit.
Well, wasn't breakfast in the kitchen?
No.
That was always at the dining room table,
every meal I ever ate there was at the dining table.
Mm-hmm. I know that the help was ate right at the table with everybody and
everybody
had...
Everybody sat there and said grace, and we all dove in.
Okay, let's see. What else?